the vector doesn't transform covariantly. And the reason that we care is that because we actually ultimately are interested in the physics of these manifolds. We want to talk about gravity. And one of the basic principles of relativity, and one of the things that Einstein did, one of his revolutions, was to take us away from this Newtonian concept of absoluteness, absolute time, or an absolute reference frame. And so if we have a situation where a particular quantity depends on the coordinate system that you're in any way other than saying, well, I've got this set of units, I'm metric, you're imperial, what's the translation between our two different sets of units? That's like the equivalent of our coordinate transformation. If that's not enough, and if there's an additional discrepancy, then that is saying that we don't agree on measurements, and therefore physics is not sensible. And so, or alternatively, it would be saying there was a preferred set of coordinates, and that goes completely contrary to the principle of relativity. So that's why we want things to be covariant. So what I'd like to do now is to talk about one particular way of taking a derivative, which is called a Lie derivative. And what the Lie derivative does is it uses a vector field to take a derivative of another vector field or tensor. So I'm thinking here of having some reference field U, which, if I've got my vector field U, that is saying that the field is tangent to this curve. So these are sort of U at different points. And then what I'm going to do, if this is my point O, I'm going to take another vector field V and I'm then going to do this process of taking a derivative by looking at my vector field some short distance away along this curve, and I'm going to compare. First of all, I know what this vector field will be there, and then I'm going to, in order to say what I compare it to, I'm going to take this V naught and I'm kind of going to move it forward along this curve. So what I mean by that is that I have my coordinates here at O. So I've got my x naught mu. I've got my coordinates at the point T. And I use my vector field to sort of give me a new set of coordinates. Now, this is a little bit into this idea of coordinate transformations or deforming manifolds. I'm not, I, I can get into the sort of details of this, but I'd rather just describe it to you. And if you're interested, you can kind of read up on the details. But when we sort of say, what's our symmetry group of gravity, of general relativity, you may have heard the phrase, well, it's a group of general coordinate transformations, or diffeomorphisms is the sort of mathematical phrase. And what that means is that you're kind of doing, you're sort of shifting those coordinate charts that you have on your manifold. And in this case, you could think of it as saying, well, here I've got a vector field U. I construct curves that U is always tangent to. And I just change my coordinates a little bit by taking them at this reference point 0 and just moving a little bit along the curve. So I have a coordinate T along the curve. I've got some sets of X's which are perpendicular to the curve. And I simply keep the X's constant as I move a little bit along this curve T. That's one way of thinking about it. So you're simply just shifting your coordinates a little bit. The idea is that it's something which doesn't really change the manifold, it just perhaps changes the way that you're viewing it. And so this is what, if you move a little way along U, you're adding a small amount of U to your background set of coordinates. And so our derivative of V along U, this Lie derivative, is going to be, just like you normally do, limit as T goes to 0, 1 over T. So we want to take our vector field at, so here I'm using this index notation here. I want to take my vector field at xt, I then want to take this V naught and transform it into the coordinate system at t. So we know that if we do a coordinate transformation on a vector, our vector transforms by the derivative, the derivative of the new coordinate system over the old one. This takes me from V naught to the V naught expressed in the coordinates at t. This, on the other hand, is the value of the vector at t. So this is the equivalent of what I was saying I wanted to do beforehand. I want to take my vector at t. I want to subtract off the vector at naught. The vector at naught is in a different vector space. I've got to make it in the same vector space. In other words, I've got to do coordinate transformation. I've got to sort of shift from one set of coordinates to another. So now I just do Taylor series. I've got V naught. I then got to take the derivative of V along this extra piece here, proportional to U. Then I have to look at my coordinate transformation, dxt with respect to dx naught. And if I just look over there, that is going to be delta mu nu plus t, the derivative of mu. So I'm only keeping terms linear in t here. Okay, so this last term here, my delta mu nu takes that mu to a mu. So that cancels with that. And now I'm just left with terms linear in t. So I can take my limit as t tends to naught. And I get oops, the derivative of v along u minus the partial derivative of u along v. So that's my Lie derivative of a vector.
Is that at time zero?
Yes. So the thing is that because I'm only keeping terms linear, you could think of, if I take that this is at v, this is v at these coordinates. So this is really that at zero, that at zero. I'm just not putting all the, because I only want linear terms. So by default, once I've got a t in front of it, everything's just, whether or not you take it at zero or t doesn't actually matter at that point, because the higher order terms go to zero and t goes to zero. So that's how you define just the Lie derivative of a single vector. You do essentially the same process if you have tensors or covectors. You take the object at the x naught plus t. You then subtract off the object at zero, transformed into the t coordinate system, and you take the limit as t goes to zero. So if you do that for a covector, and this might actually be a nice thing to do in the tutorial, then you will find that the minus simply changes it to a plus. So the rule of the game is the Lie derivative, just to sort of deconstruct it, is that you take a partial derivative along your vector, and I probably should use u to be consistent, I apologize for that. You take a partial derivative of your object quantity along the vector, and then for each index that your tensor carries, you take a derivative of the vector field that you're taking, that you're doing your Lie derivative with respect to. If it's an upstairs index, if you get a minus sign and you're taking, doing a contraction over that upstairs index, the derivative of your background field. If it's a downstairs one, then it's a plus sign and it's at that point. So that's your sort of natural extension for tensors. So what this Lie derivative, I've tried to define it here, talking about the normal way you define a derivative, talking about taking some geometrical quantity, in this case a vector, and moving it a little bit along the curve. But actually, for vectors, just for vectors, this, if you notice, this thing here has, it's, you're taking the derivative of a vector and you obtain a vector. And what that means is that you've got some operation which maps you from it takes you from a vector, from two vectors to one vector. And this can be written as the Lie bracket, which is something that you will be much more familiar with from sort of looks a bit more like quantum mechanics. So if I go back to this geometric notation, I didn't have to do all this hoopla of thinking about how I transform my vectors from one, you know, one point on the curve to another. I could have simply defined my Lie bracket, my Lie derivative through this Lie bracket, because if you remember, I defined, or I said vectors gave you a map from, took a function and also gave you another function, so like tf was df dt. And so what if you act on a function with a vector and get a function, then you can also act with a second vector. And then you simply take the anti-symmetric product of that. And so this gives you exactly the same expression here. Yes?
Is there a way to see how the covector form looks from that kind of an argument?
No, this really is just the just acting on vectors, because it's, you know, in this particular case, you know, you can't, you know, the covectors are natural vectors in the wheels, whereas your vectors acting on, you know, are just simple functions.
Right. I was just wondering if there's some way to see it from
that. I mean, another way, rather than again going through that expression in terms of the derivative, another way of getting this is saying that your covector was a map from vectors to the reals, and therefore you know that if you take a derivative of just a function, you ought to just simply, you know, get a simple derivative of, you know, of the function without any extra sort of vectorial pieces. And so if you took the combination omega alpha u alpha and then took a Lie derivative, you would need to have the extra pieces with the derivatives of v cancelling each other off. So you can sort of see that they've got a hope of doing that with the plus rather than the minus. So that's another way of getting that. Rather than going back to first principles, you could say, well, I know that this is a scalar, so it has to transform as a scalar, so I can't have those extra terms. So that's another way of getting it. So just to see what the geometrical significance, the Lie derivative has, I guess, I mean, apart from, I'm about to sort of describe two ways in which we normally encounter it, I think it's geometrical significance, but quite often, when you sort of think about derivatives, or you're thinking about taking rates of change, what you're often actually imagining doing in the back of your mind is taking a Lie derivative, because you're often thinking about the way something changes along a particular direction, which is defined by a set of curves. So if, you know, so although it's something which I gather you didn't actually do, it is something which comes, you know, which comes you come across quite a lot. Because what you often do when you're trying to solve problems in gravity, you're often thinking about taking some particular set of curves, which might be, it could be a set of geodesics. You might be interested in the way some sort of family of geodesics behave. It may be that these things sort of represent an extra dimension, and you want to sort of look how something behaves as you move out into an extra dimension. Or it might be, and which I'll come to in a moment, it might be that these directions represent symmetries. So whenever you think about things like symmetries or transporting things into extra dimensions, you often end up coming back to this Lie derivative. So if I have this Lie bracket, what it actually says, what I could imagine is, let's get my labeling right. I could imagine going a little distance s along a curve v, and then another little distance t along my vector field u, or I could do it in the other order. And in general, these two operations don't have to commute. And this Lie derivative tells you how far this process is from closing. So this thing here, this gap, although I've dramatically exaggerated it, is actually what the Lie derivative is. So the way you show this is you say, well, if I want to calculate x at b, then that's going to be x at a. Make sure that absolute is going along v. So what I do is I'm now going to second order, because what I end up with is actually second order in S and T. So first of all, what I want to do is I want to take, to get from A to B, I have to go along this curve defined by V. I do my Taylor expansion, which is therefore the X at A plus S times V at A plus a half S squared times the derivative of V along V at A. Now, I want to go back to 0, to O, and not A. So XA, I get to A by going a distance T along U. So that's T times U. I now want to take V at A, and I need to go to 0. Now, this last term, because this is already quadratic, I can simply change that A to a 0 straight off. So this now is what the coordinates of B are correct to second order. If I want to get the coordinates at D, all I do is I swap S and T and U and V. So that would start off X plus S V naught, etc. So then if I now take the difference, you'll notice here that obviously if I take the difference, the x0 terms will cancel. Here I've got tu plus sv. If I swap s and t and u and v simultaneously, these linear terms will also cancel. Now if I look at the quadratic terms, I've got t squared, the derivative of u along u, and s squared, the derivative of v along v. Again, I swap s and t, I swap u and v. Those terms will also cancel. So what I'm actually left with is an st term. So the st term here is the derivative of v along u. Minus, if I swap my u and v, the derivative of u along v, which is, of course, st, the commutator of u and v, which is what I set out to prove. So the Lie derivative is kind of telling us by, if we were trying to form a set of coordinates, for example, then we would normally think of, when we set up our normal x, y, z coordinates, our coordinates tell us to go a distance x along the x-axis, y along the y-axis, and z up the z-axis. In this case, it would tell you if you tried to do that, you wouldn't quite make it because you'd end up at a different point. And of course, that doesn't normally happen in sort of standard Cartesians. So the other main thing that Lie derivatives tell you about are, or they're also used when to tell you about symmetries of the metric. So I believe you've met a Killing vector. So something that's really useful in general relativity is symmetry. Symmetries of your metric. Because you basically, until very recently, it was not practical to do relativity numerically. And so if you wanted to try and find physically useful solutions to the Einstein equations, you tended to have to be rather crafty about how you analyze the Einstein equations. And what that meant in practice was you looked for systems with a lot of symmetry. Now, fortunately, the most interesting systems in nature do have a lot of symmetry. Our universe has a lot of symmetry, at least on the broad brush scale. And in the case of cosmology, you reduce your Einstein equations down to a single dynamical variable of a single parameter, which is time. And that is devastatingly successful. It gives us the Big Bang Theory with very little effort. In terms of other useful systems, probably the primary most useful system, actually, is spherical symmetry. We know, of course, that our solar system isn't exactly spherically symmetric, or the Earth isn't exactly spherically symmetric, But it's a good approximation. If you think about the planets or our star, the sun, the rotation speed is in relativistic terms, quite small. And so it's a good approximation to think of them as just being static and spherically symmetric. So once again, more symmetries. Static asymmetry with respect to time, spherically symmetric symmetries with respect to rotations. And once you take these symmetries, these killing equations, which are also entirely equivalent, and I'm not sure, well, you must have seen it in this form, actually, that the symmetrized derivative, covariant derivative of the vector is zero. So just those equations, the fact that the metric is invariant as you sort of pull it round these the curves of your vector field V, simplifies the form that you use for G immensely, which then means that when you calculate your curvatures, they have a relatively simple form, and therefore the differential equations, your Einstein equations, can usually be solved, if not exactly, at least implicitly. So the killing vectors are important. Lie derivatives, which give rise to the killing vectors, are also important in this notion of symmetry and the idea of choosing nice coordinate systems. So it's a combination. You probably did the idea of symmetry with your killing vector, but the Lie derivative is also going to sort of tell you something about how to set up coordinates, which is probably kind of taken for granted, but it's kind of the machinery behind being able to set up nice coordinates once you've got symmetries. So that sort of ties in with something you've already seen anyway. So what I'd like to do then is talk about another way of taking a derivative. Which sort of completes the toolkit, if you like, of doing differentiation on manifolds. So the final way you can take a derivative, which, like the Lie derivative, does not require a metric or a connection, is something called an exterior derivative. But the exterior derivative strictly only applies to things that we call differential forms. So if you've met differential forms, you'll have met them in the sense of covariant tensors, things with indices all downstairs, that are completely anti-symmetric. So that is, in essence, what a differential form is. So D, the exterior derivative, so before, when I was asked about a sort of geometrical notion of what the covectors were, I kind of drew these surfaces of F equaled constant. And so this is really where this comes from, this idea of taking a derivative of the function So you take, this is your one form. You can think of it as sort of like df by dx mu if you're in a coordinate basis. But if you wanted to do it in this sort of geometrical sense, remember covectors take a vector and map it into the reals. So what df does, if you take an arbitrary vector, then it takes df, contracted with this x, is just the vector x acting on f. And that's got to be true for every single vector that you pick. So if you picked the coordinate basis, so remember our coordinate basis was just d by dx, then you would expect to get df by dx mu. So hence that sketch of saying, you know, that this idea of surfaces of f equals constant, when you were thinking about that as representing one of these covectors or one forms. So far, that doesn't really seem like any big deal. Yeah?
Sorry, what is the coordinate basis?
Well, no, I'm just saying this is an example.
Oh.
This is your basis vector in a coordinate basis. And so, you know, XF, this always looks a bit, I don't know, not, it's not so, we're more used to this sort of thing. I think that's why I'm saying it. We're more used to that expression or that notation. So really, for acting on functions, this is just the same. It would be the same as the covariant derivative. I haven't actually introduced anything radically new here. But the real difference and why this has its own label of D is that you can extend this notion to act on these, instead of just functions, to act on things that we call differential forms, which are these anti-symmetric tensors. I don't think I introduced this terminology. So the way you construct, so we say it's a member. So the idea is you take an anti-symmetric product of tensors. Yes, Callum?
Yes.
Yeah.
Let me call it something else, Q. We call my point Q.
And what's P?
So P is how many indices the forms have. So this is where it's actually easier to see in terms of that index notation. Here, yeah.
Probably already put one P down, which is why I changed
it. What's the number?
So you construct this by taking anti-symmetric products. Which is this wedge product, okay? So you would take, if you had two, one form, so if you have two covectors, A and B, you would take the tensor product of A with B, you would subtract the tensor product of B with A, and that would be the wedge product. So in terms of indices, you would take this anti-symmetric expression. So if I have two arbitrary rank forms, use this notation, if you come across this notation, square brackets and round brackets on indices. No. Okay. So I actually got a question on the example sheet about it. So this notation is taking the anti-symmetric, taking all permutations. Of the indices, and then weighted by the sign of the permutation. So round brackets is a symmetric. If you had round brackets, you would just take the indices, you would add them up. It would be like symmetrizing all the indices. So it would be all pluses, with all possible permutations, orders of the indices. For the square brackets, it's an anti-symmetric, an anti-symmetrization of your indices. It means that this notation says take all possible permutations of these indices. If it's an even permutation, it comes with a plus sign. An odd permutation comes with a minus sign. So that's what that actually means. So there's a question on the sheet for you to have a go at. Yes?
And what's the convention? Would you divide by factorials?
Right, so, so in this case, that's why I've got a p plus q factorial there, because, yeah, so you would say that, let me just do this as an aside. So if I had q mu there, this would be a half q mu nu minus q mu nu, and q round bracket mu nu would be a half of q mu nu plus q mu nu. So that's why I've got that thingy there. It's just it's a useful form of notation. So what this, roughly speaking, what this is doing, what the forms are doing, is by making everything completely anti-symmetric. Remember when you did the connection, the metric connection,
it's all symmetric. The gamma functions are all symmetric on the lower indices. So if you, this is very non-respectful saying it, but if you anti-symmetrize everything, it's essentially killing off all of the connection components that you would have if you were taking a covariant derivative. It's killing off this term when you try taking a simple partial derivative of a vector, you change coordinates, you find it doesn't transform covariantly because there's an extra piece, which is the second derivative of, you know, of one set of coordinates with respect to the other. That's a symmetric thing on that second derivative. And so if you anti-symmetrize everything, it kills off that extra term. So the wedge product is linear, but it's obviously not commutative. So if I've got my A wedge B, I can potentially pick up a minus sign if I reverse the order of multiplication. So what this exterior derivative does is it acts on these anti-symmetric tensors. It acts on these forms, and D just like it took a function to a covector, D takes a P form. To a P plus one form. So it would take, what it actually does is it takes this A form. And it takes a completely anti-symmetric derivative. And then to get the combinatorial factors right, I just have to do that. So my exterior derivative simply says, take a partial derivative, completely anti-symmetrize, and then there's a sort of an accounting factor that you've got to add in. But this object is completely geometrical. You don't need a metric, and you don't need a connection. So I'm thinking here as A is a P form, B is a Q form. So D behaves like a derivation. It's got this sort of Leibnizian property, but with a twist, it just has a potential minus sign if you've got a sort of like odd number of indices on the A. There's also a simple relation between D and the, yes, sorry?
You said that the exterior derivative is totally geometric; it doesn't depend on the connection. But you have a derivative like in the definition, so.
Connection. This is a partial derivative.
So we choose a special covariant derivative.
No, there's no covariant. This is just right. So the partial derivative is just like d by dx, d by dx or d by dy. You can always do a partial derivative in terms of a local coordinate chart on anything you like. It might not mean very much, but you can always do it. But if you want to have things that make sense, then you want to have some, that's what I've been calling geometrical. It means that they transform covariantly. So the connection is something that you add to your partial derivative to get a meaningful covariant derivative. So if you recall, when you take the covariant derivative of a vector, there are two pieces to it. There's the sort of partial derivative, dv by dx mu, and then you add the gamma pieces in. Now you've got then a gamma times v. So your covariant derivative is the partial derivative together with some connection components, which are the gammas. So the partial derivative is something which is you just do with respect to some local coordinate system.
I think Aaron's asking, sorry, how come there's no gamma here?
Because it doesn't need to be.
Because they cancel, right?
Yeah. That's the whole point. It doesn't need a connection. You don't need to put a gamma in here because the gamma, have to be symmetric, but if you think about it in terms of the gamma that you've met, yeah? If you were to try and take a covariant derivative of A here, you would have the partial derivative, and for every index of A, you'd have a gamma coefficient. And on the gamma would be, at the bottom, let's take the first index, it would be gamma A1, A2, C, A, C, A3, etc. The A1, A2 here is being anti-symmetrized. And so the gamma that you're used to would just drop out at that point.
So if I chose another derivative, del prime, it would be the same?
Yes. So whichever way you try and cook it, all your connection terms cancel. So it's something where, if you've got a connection, it doesn't matter. You could make that a covariant grad there. But you don't have to have a connection to do this. This works with partial derivatives. So just to wrap up, in short, let me just write down this relation. So for a one form omega, if I take d omega, that's two form. And then if I take this combination, take the two form takes two vectors to number, then d omega on u v is the same as u acting on the scalar omega v minus v acting on the scalar omega u minus the contraction of omega with the Lie bracket of u and v. So one example, just got 1 minute left, I'll use it. Perhaps if you think about this, the most common example that you've come across for these differential forms is the electromagnetic field. So the
in that case, you've got the electromagnetic gauge potential. And,
a one-form, one-form, and d omega is a two-form. So the left-hand side, that's a number.
Yes, this is a two-form.
And that's a tensor product.
And this is two vectors.
And so on the right-hand side, that seems to be a vector. Is that?
No, this is the vector acting on the function.
I see.
So it's the function. Yeah. So it's vector on the function. So. Yeah, I know, that's... But you're actually used to forms, because the gauge, the electromagnetic gauge potential gives you the Maxwell 2 form, which is just d mu a mu minus d mu a mu. So this is electromagnetism. So remember, you've got your standard... Your gauge potential is just some 4 covector, which is the scalar potential and the sort of standard vector potential in the three-dimensional sense. And so the 2 form, and I'm bound to get my signs messed up, so apologies for that in advance. So if you look at what... the electric field is the sort of naught I component of the two form. And the magnetic field is the sort of completely spatial part of this Maxwell two form. So electromagnetism is the most familiar example of forms in action, but there are also generalizations. You can have gauge potentials which are not one forms but can be p forms. So you have a two form or a three form, for example, gauge potential, in which case, generalizing this idea of electromagnetism, your field strength in those cases is just the exterior derivative of that gauge potential with a similar sort of expression as this. So I'm out of time, but it's a good point at which to stop. And what we've done is we've very, very rapidly gone through a little bit of the maths behind some of the stuff that you've already met in the more physical context. I realize this all is quite formal, but I was told that this was a good idea to try and see some of the more mathematical side of general relativity. I want to just continue next time with, just beg your indulgence for a little bit more formalism. I'm going to actually combine the expressions of this idea of differential forms, exterior differentiation, to derive what are known as the Cartan equations, which tell you about the structure of the curvature and connections. I'm now going to bring in the idea of metrics, connections and curvatures. And it gives you a little bit of a look at the algebra behind general relativity and curvature. It's also a very nice, neatable, efficient way of calculating curvatures. And then in future classes, what I want to do is use these techniques to actually derive for you Kaluza-Klein theory. So Kaluza-Klein theory is where you have extra dimensions. And how do you reduce the curvature in more dimensions down to an expression in 4 dimensions? So a little bit more formalism to build up something of a toolkit, and then we'll start actually using it to look at things like spherically symmetric systems useful for black holes, and also this Kaluza-Klein theory. So I guess this afternoon's tutorial will be a little bit of revision and probably looking a little bit more at the Lie derivative, and if you can manage it, rather than that.
Okay, so